Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're up, we're down, no wait, maybe back up a bit? The stock market goes on a wild October ride. What does all this mean, anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 16th of October, and it is great to have you with us. We are going to start things off with a roller coaster, which is pretty much what the U.S. stock markets felt like all this week. The causes? Well, take your pick. Ebola, trouble in Europe, fear of what might happen when the Fed ends its bond buying program. But we want to talk about the effects of all that volatility, what the bouncy ride means for people, and not just sad traders with their heads in their hands. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn starts us off.
Economist Nick Bloom has studied the real-world impact of stock market jitters going back to the JFK assassination. Big swings in the markets were normally followed by nasty economic contractions.
And the reason is reasonably easy to see.
It's the fear effect. When individuals and businesses are uncertain about the future, they put off big purchases.
So, for example, firm investment tends to drop very heavily. If you look at consumers, you see it's consumer durables that drops a lot. So things like new cars, furniture, clothing.
But before you lock up your credit cards, Bloom also says the volatility we've seen this week is all smoke and no fire so far. First, consider stock prices. Russ Kinnell at Morningstar says they've lost at most the gains from 1 year of a five-year rally.
I think at this point, if, say, we were lucky and things didn't get any worse, probably not too big of an impact.
Then consider the stock volatility. Professor Bloom looks at a measurement called the VIX.
It's risen by about 50% over the last week. Historically, big jumps that I've examined have a VIX increase of more than 100%.
They also lasted a full month. Gary Thayer, macro strategist at Wells Fargo, thinks when this stock market stabilizes, so will any fear on the part of consumers.
After it's out of the news, people's perceptions and sentiment tend to shift back. And that's, I think, what we're likely to see here.
After some ups and downs today, the market ended up pretty much where it started. But you'll hear more about that when we do the numbers. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Now to the other big story of the day, Ebola. By now, both of the Dallas nurses who are sick with Ebola have been transferred to specialty hospitals with biocontainment units. There are four of these in the U.S. On some level, it makes sense. Doctors and hospitals alike specialize. For a heart problem, we see a cardiologist. If you have cancer, you go to an oncologist. So why should Ebola be any different? From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
There really aren't any Ebola experts out there, no super docs who've got special tricks. That means treating Ebola is pretty straightforward business.
Most of the treatment issues really are, in some ways, the generic treatment of very, very sick people with multiple organs that are failing. And most reasonable size hospitals can do that competently.
That's Dr. Bob Wachter of the University of California, San Francisco. Wachter says with Ebola, what matters more than medical brilliance is organizational acumen, where everyone from the hospital CEO to the top nurse to the waste hauler knows how to handle something this infectious.
And there, that's really, really hard, and I don't think every single hospital will be able to sort that out.
Clearly, the problem in Dallas drives that home. But what's happened in Dallas shouldn't come as a shock. Remember, estimates suggest nearly 100,000 people die from hospital-acquired infections every year. Mistakes in hospitals happen. They're expected. But with Ebola, the stakes may be too high, so cases should go to top hospitals. Or maybe not.
I don't really think at this point we need to transfer everybody to a specialized center.
Dr. Ricardo Martinez oversaw EMS efforts for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Martinez says every hospital needs to be better prepared.
There are other diseases coming, and so we should be able to provide some levels of protection that help not only care for the patient, but contain the spread.
Martinez says if Doctors Without Borders can protect many of its workers in field-like settings, U.S. hospitals should be able to do the same. If not for Ebola, then for the next infectious disease that blows in. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Those volatile markets we told you about, as Stan said earlier, they went up, they went down. They ended up right back about where they started. There'll be more when you hear that numbers music. Imagine the water you use in your house when you brush your teeth, take a shower, even water the lawn. This week, California's water agencies will tally up how much their local customers use and report it to the state. The drought there is so serious that you might even get a bill that labels you as wasteful. It's one of the ways utilities are trying to make their customers more water thrifty without resorting to the R word, rationing. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Let's be clear. Water rationing does work, but politicians are loath to do it.
Rationing is sort of an ugly word.
Jay Lund runs the Center for Watershed Sciences at the University of California, Davis. He says politicians reserve the R word for true emergencies.
Because you want to save that public awareness and public spiritedness for when it's really needed. Otherwise, you get accused of crying wolf, and you can get unelected as a board member for a water district if you cry wolf too often.
A few California cities do face a dire shortage and are rationing. Others are better off, but they want to avoid rationing in the future. California's water regulators are encouraging them to consider something called water budgeting. You can find water budgeting here in Irvine, an affluent suburb in Orange County. The smell of fresh-cut grass fills the air in a neighborhood where gardeners are blowing clippings off the sidewalks. If there's a drought here, you wouldn't know it.
You can see it looks nice and green, a couple of little brown patches there. But this
Fiona Sanchez is director of water resources for the Irvine Ranch Water District. Here, she says, your water bill acts as water cop.
If you're wasting water, we're going to send you a very strong price signal to let you know that you have wasteful use.
Here's the SparkNotes version. Every household gets a, quote, reasonable monthly water budget based on specifics like family size and how big your property is. Right now, it's 50 gallons per person per day for indoors. Outdoors, enough to maintain a grass lawn, even in a drought. Stay within your water budget, you pay some of the lowest water rates in the county. Go over, you pay more. And they call you names.
We call it inefficient, and it's printed that way on the water bill.
That's for folks who exceed their budget by up to 30%. Go higher, they call you excessive and charge you even more. Abandon all water sense and reach the highest tier of use, you get the disdainful, wasteful label and major sticker shock.
It's designed to get the customer's attention and think, oh, whoa, well, my water bill went from something like, you know, $28 up to maybe, you know, $90.
In fact, Irvine's wasteful water users can pay up to 9 times as much as their efficient neighbors. Sanchez says since they created water budgeting in 1991, their customers use half as much water outdoors, and per capita water use is way under the state average. But here's the thing. Only a dozen or so water agencies in the entire country charge for water this way. What's up with that?
It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of resources.
Felicia Marcus is chair of California's Water Resources Control Board.
Because you need to be able to work with your community to come up with what, say, a reasonable indoor water use is for a family of four.
And costly climate data to estimate a reasonable outdoor water use. And some water boards view it as just a more subtle form of rationing they fear ratepayers will reject. But Tom Ash, who helped create water budgeting, argues politically it's easier than mandating a cutback because that puts customers who are already conserving water in a squeeze.
So I would say it's a much more equitable and a much nicer scenario than rationing.
And if you design it right, Ash says, an agency can still cover its fixed costs even if it's selling less water. That's a common problem at water agencies everywhere.
They're asking people to use less water, they're losing money, and then they have to raise rates. And so it makes everybody mad.
Mad enough to make water boards want to try something new. Ash says by next year, he'll be advising a dozen water utilities in Southern California that want to see whether water budgets do make good water cops. In Irvine, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
I can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth in October, but the holiday shopping season is coming. And with it, the usual holiday hiring spree. Amazon will take on 80,000 people to work in its fulfillment centers. UPS is hiring too, and the list goes on. These seasonal jobs boost temporary workers' bank accounts, and they may help pay for some gifts. But does the work really boost their job prospects? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes a look.
For at least some of the people Amazon's taking on, this will be a long-term opportunity, says company spokesperson Nina Lindsay.
Last year, Amazon converted thousands of seasonal employees into regular full-time roles after the holidays. And we're really excited to be expecting to do the same this year.
That turned out to be about 15% of the temps who got holiday work. But how good are the jobs? Check online and you'll see they're above minimum wage in the $11 to $15 an hour range.
In this kind of economy with this lack of safety net, any job is often better than no job.
That's Stephanie Luce, professor of labor studies at the City University of New York. She says with so many people wanting full-time permanent employment and not able to find it,
you're taking this job. It might even be your second job or third job, but you're just trying to patch together many different temp jobs, seasonal jobs, part-time jobs to make a living. And it's really not a sustainable model.
But at least it's job experience for the resume, right? Georgetown's Harry Holzer served in the Labor Department during the Clinton administration.
You know, if it's really short term, I doubt that anyone's going to be impressed by it when they look at somebody's work experience. But if it's a little longer, and if you can argue that you picked up a skill on the job, then potentially it could have a positive effect.
At least the temporary income can help pay some bills and maybe make the holidays a little more festive. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My son sent a note. He said, hey, why don't you just ask everybody what they want to see? So I did on Twitter. I asked whatever, 500,000 people. So what do you want a picture of? And everybody said, I want a picture of my hometown.
An astronaut goes to space in the age of social media. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down 24 points, a tenth of 1% at 16,117. The NASDAQ moved the other way, eking out a gain of 2 points, less than a tenth percent, to close at 4217, while the S&P 500 traded flat to slightly lower, ending at 1862. We talked about the recent volatility earlier in the show, and while the wider economy may not benefit from all the ups and downs, Goldman Sachs certainly does. Goldman said volatility helped it make a lot of money in trading last quarter, but today Goldman closed down more than 2.5%. Bond prices pulled back a little. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.15%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for September. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary October consumer sentiment survey. And fans of the film The Big Lebowski converge in Chicago for Lebowski Fest. Activities include a screening, costume contest, and bowling, of course. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Think back to the playground of your childhood. You maybe had swings, monkey bars, a metal slide that got really hot in the summer. That was your basic neighborhood park. Everybody knew where it was, no Facebook page or glossy pamphlets necessary. Public parks are very different now, and so is the way they're branding themselves. Gigi Duban reports.
Want to try a belly dancing class? Do a little Tai Chi? Forget joining a gym, and seriously, step away from that glowing screen already. Instead, go to the park. That's the message park officials around the country are sending out to workaholics and tech addicts alike.
Really, just in general, everyone's lives are so busy that our competition is mostly just with people's schedules and the busyness of the day-to-day.
That's Ryan Hegrinus, Marketing and Enterprise Development Manager for Arlington Parks and Recreation in Texas. His job is to get people to the parks, the golf courses, the pools, and rec centers in Arlington. This past spring, his department launched a marketing campaign, Unplug and Connect.
And the whole purpose of that marketing effort was to just encourage people to unplug from their devices or unplug from work and spend time connecting with their families, connecting with the golf ball or softball or whatever it may be.
Hegrinus says parks can't count on tax revenue for support anymore. Cities and states are cutting funding. So he says parks are under a lot of pressure to generate their own revenue, just like any business. Take the City Rec Center here in Homewood, Alabama. For around $200 a year, a family gets access to the pool, fitness center, a track. And for an extra fee, there are amenities like this karate class. Yoga and Zumba are other fee-based classes. But parks have to be really careful here, says Setha Lowe. She's director of the Public Space Research Group in New York. She says branding and marketing could draw in more people.
But branding could probably also be used to make some parks less diverse.
Say if the programs target only the upper middle class. And less diversity, she says, goes against the most basic mission of parks, which is to serve everyone in a community. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Hey, stop listening to the show and click here right now. Okay, that doesn't actually work on the radio. It turns out it doesn't work so well online either. People click on the average ad on the internet about 0.1% of the time. But that doesn't mean online ads don't work. Marketers just need a better way to measure them. Sam Harnett has our story.
Right now, companies mostly pay for online ads based on how often they are shown and clicked. Tony Hale wants to change that.
I want a web designed to capture my attention, not just my index finger.
Hale is the CEO of Chartbeat. His company is trying to quantify our attention. Did we really take a good look at that ad, or just accidentally click it on our way to watch a cat video? To figure that out, Chartbeat tracks things like how you move your mouse, scroll, and tap on your keyboard.
All of those signals effectively allow us to get a picture of behavior that gives us a sense of when attention is happening or when someone's distracted.
For years, Chartbeat has been measuring attention for actual content. News organizations, for example, use it and other services to see what articles engage readers. You might recognize a few of Chartbeat's clients: The New York Times, CNN, Wall Street Journal, and Marketplace. Now some companies are using it for ads. John Slade directs digital advertising for the Financial Times.
I'm now able to value the engagement in the advertising department and commercialize that engagement.
Slade says his site can now sell ads based on how long people see and engage with them, rather than how many times they are clicked on. It's quality over quantity, he says. A huge shift for online advertising, and a better business model for those who create content, says Trevor Fellows.
The recognition that not all impressions are equal is huge.
Fellows is the chief revenue officer for the Wall Street Journal. He says attention metrics will show advertisers it's worth paying to have ads displayed next to engaging content. It's a way for news sites to stand out from the soup that is the internet. But Fellows says it will be a while before engagement becomes a standard measurement in the advertising industry.
A change of this magnitude is going to be a long time in becoming commonplace.
Advertisers still quibble over the old metrics, how to determine whether an ad has actually been viewed and intentionally clicked. When it comes to human attention, there's more going on than just the push of a button. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
He's arguably the most famous astronaut of the modern era, not just because of his trips to space. Commander Chris Hadfield won a massive following using Twitter and Instagram, even singing David Bowie covers on YouTube, because he invited people to share his experiences on the International Space Station. Now he's gathered thousands of photographs he took from space and whittled them down into a book called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes. Commander Hadfield, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
All right, 92 minutes. You condensed some 45,000 pictures from the International Space Station into this book. I know you're not going to pick a favorite for me, but why'd you choose the ones you chose?
Well, I went through the 45,000 pictures and started a file going, okay, well, that one's interesting. Oh, that one's interesting. And then, you know, that whittled it down to a few thousand until eventually I had what was as if you were by the window next to me going around the world once together and sort of the highlights of the planet. At one point, I sent out a tweet. My son sent a note. He said, hey, why don't you just ask everybody what they want to see? And I did on Twitter. I asked whatever, 500,000 people, so what do you want a picture of? And everybody said, I want a picture of my hometown, which made me laugh because at first I thought it's kind of like, you know, narcissistic. But then I thought about it and people are proud of where they're from. But also, I want to see where I'm from in proportion and in perspective with everywhere else. I want to see how I fit in. I think that idea of a global view of self is what is attractive to so many people, why people are interested in how the world looks from the space station.
Space programs, though, are in pretty rough economic shape. There are not a lot of people who get to have the experience you have. I wonder if some of the enthusiasm people have shown for your experience recaptures a little bit of that, you know, fire for this that we saw in maybe the early and mid-'80s, for
example. Actually, I disagree with what you just said.
Really?
We have never had more presence in space. We've had people permanently, Americans permanently on the space station for the last 14 years. The total sum of their space experience dwarfs all other experience we've ever had leading
up to
that.
Even though you see government budgets go down?
Budgets always go up and down. I mean, that's what budgets do. There are always cycles. It's easy to say, well, you know, it was better before. The reality is, United States led the program to build the International Space Station. People have been living there for 14 years, and we understand the world better now as a result of that than we ever have.
Connect the two for me. The public love that a lot of people have fallen into with you and your photographs, and this moment that we're in where we see money from private corporations go into space travel, and how those things come together. Do you see this book and what you're doing as a way to throw more attention into that?
Boy, I'm not throwing anything. All I did was invite people on board using the technology that we invented and the technology we put on the space station, allowing people to basically have a two-way interactive conversation with the crew on board. People's curiosity, the same curiosity that makes a 10-month-old start to walk, that wanting to use mobility to understand things better, that, I think, is what drives so many people's interest to come on board. Commercial venture, that's just a natural evolution. When we first built railroads, it was all purely government and then became largely private. When we first built airplanes, there was so much work. NACA, the predecessor to NASA, spent a vast amount of money, created all the technology that then, 50 years later, allowed commercial aviation to start to really take off and be profitable around the world. We've only been in space for 50 years, and we're just now starting to turn the corner where maybe the government isn't the only customer, where maybe it can become safe enough and therefore cheap enough that other people can start to be the customer.
What's it like to think inside the space station? Does that focus your thoughts? Is it a different way of being than it is when you're walking around on Earth?
On the space station, there are countless people demanding things of you all the time. There's this red line moves across a schedule that tells you what to do every 5 minutes for 6 months. So there's that sense of expectation and urgency. And if you got a little bit of time, do this and do this and do this. But at the same time, there's an enormous sense of honor to be there. You are there on behalf of literally millions of people that are trusting you to do it right, but also trusting you to try and not waste it. No, don't squander it. If you've got 5 minutes, do 1,000 somersaults. Try an experiment. Spill some water and put some lemon pepper oil in the middle and see how it behaves. Go to the window and take a picture of someplace you've never seen and then share that with everybody else. It's really sort of addictive to be up there, to have that real strong sense of purpose.
What's next for you? What's your next job after that? Are we going to see you pilot any of the commercial operations are going, maybe?
I know several of the guys that are flying Richard Branson's, what is Spaceship One, I think he calls it, Virgin Galactic. And it's a really interesting first commercial step. I don't think I'm going to be the pilot of it. I've been a pilot my whole life. And a little taste of a ride like that would be, you know, be like a Formula One driver going for a quick ride in somebody else's car. But if someone gives me the opportunity, I'll go, for sure. But I don't think I'm going to be the pilot, no.
Commander Chris Hadfield, author of You Are Here, thanks so much for your time.
Nice to talk with you. Thank you.
We have Chris Hadfield's photos and, hey, maybe even a couple of your hometown. They're at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Bono is sorry. The U2 frontman apologized to everyone who was annoyed that a new U2 album just showed up on their iTunes accounts. Bono and the rest of U2 did a question and answer session with fans on Facebook. Over video, Bono said he just got carried away, adding that the auto-download album Songs of Innocence was originally a beautiful idea, but he said artists are prone to a drop of megalomania and they fear their albums won't be heard. According to Billboard, 26 million people downloaded the album in its entirety. No number on how many actually meant to. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow finished down 24 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ went the other way, eking out a gain of 2 points. The S&P 500, flat to slightly lower. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Kyra's Doll is back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.